exactly as it is, Leonardo wrote, because the eye that sees it is not equally remote from all its edges. If you stand far enough away from a picture, even a large one, the problem of the edges being at a different distance from you diminishes. Leonardo determined that a proper vantage point for a large picture should be 10 to 20 times its width or height. Stand back until your eye is at least 20 times as far off as the greatest height and width of your work, he wrote at one point. This will make so little difference when the eye of the spectator moves that it will be hardly appreciable. In the case of the Last Supper, which is 15 feet high and 29 feet wide, that would mean the proper vantage would be 300 to 600 feet back, clearly not possible. So Leonardo created an artificial ideal vantage point that was about 30 feet from the wall. In addition, he made it 15 feet off the ground, at eye level with Jesus. No friar would ever view it from such a location, of course. But after making that spot the ideal vantage point, Leonardo proceeded to use optical tricks to make it seem less distorted from a variety of other places in the room from which it would actually be viewed. Most cleverly, he adjusted and fudged slightly so that the perspective looks natural when viewed from a door in the right wall from which the monks entered. This meant that their first striking perception was that of Jesus' left hand, palm up, directed right at them, as if welcoming them to the room. The angles of the ceiling are slightly higher on the right side. That makes the plane of the picture appear as if it is at eye level of the viewer coming in the door. Because the right wall of the painting is closer to the viewer entering from the door and is lit brighter, it looks bigger and feels a natural continuation of the refectory. Leonardo used a few tricks to disguise the fact that he had manipulated the perspective. The lines where the floor hits the back and side walls are completely hidden by the table. If you look at the picture carefully and try to imagine the floor lines, you can sense that they would have appeared distorted. In addition, a painted cornice disguises the fact that the ceiling does not extend all the way out to above the table. Otherwise, viewers would have noticed that Leonardo slightly accelerated the perspective of the ceiling. This use of accelerated perspective, in which the walls and ceiling recede toward the vanishing point more quickly than normal, was one of the many tricks that Leonardo learned from the theatrical events he produced. In Renaissance productions, the stage would contain not a rectangular room, but one that rapidly became narrower and shorter, to give the illusion of greater depth. It sloped downward toward the audience, and the artificial nature of the scenery was disguised by a decorated cornice, just like the one Leonardo used atop the Last Supper. His use of such artifices is another example of why his work on plays and pageants was not time squandered. In The Last Supper, the painted room diminishes in size so quickly that the back wall is just large enough to have three windows showing the landscape outside. The tapestries are not proportional. The table is too narrow for a comfortable supper, and the apostles are all on one side of it, where there are not enough places for them to sit. The floor is raked forward, like a stage, and the table is slanted a bit towards us as well. The characters are all at the forefront, as if in a play, and even their gestures are theatrical. The tricks of perspective are accompanied by other clever contrivances, including little touches to make the scene appear as if it is connected to the monks eating in the refectory. The light in the painting appears to come from the actual window that is high on the left wall of the refectory, blending reality with imagination. See figure 76. Look at the right wall in the painting. It's bathed in afternoon light as if from an actual window. Also, notice the legs of the table. Their shadows are cast as if from this source. The tablecloth shows alternating concave and convex folds, as if it had been pressed and stored in the monk's laundry room before being put on the table. Two little serving platters have eels garnished with fruit slices. They have no obvious religious or iconographic meaning, however. River eels were popular in Italy at the time, and we know that Leonardo, although usually a vegetarian, put eels and apricots on at least one of his shopping lists. All told, The Last Supper is a mix of scientific perspective and theatrical license, of intellect and fantasy, worthy of Leonardo. His study of perspective science had not made him rigid or academic as a painter. Instead, it was complemented by the cleverness and ingenuity he had picked up as a stage impresario. Once he knew the rules, he became a master at fudging and distorting them, as if creating perspectival sfumato. Deterioration and restoration. When Leonardo used oil paint, he would apply a stroke or two, touch and retouch, meditate for a while, then add a few more layers until he had it perfect. This permitted him to show subtle gradations in shadows and blur the borders of objects. His strokes were so light and layered that individual brush strokes are imperceptible, and he sometimes waited hours or days before gently adding more thin layers and retouchings. Unfortunately, this leisurely process was not a luxury allowed the painter of a typical wall fresco, which required that the paint be applied onto wet plaster in order to remain fixed. Once a patch of plaster had been put on the wall, that area of the painting had to be completed in one day's session before it dried and could not easily be reworked later. Verrocchio, who did not paint frescoes, never taught the technique to his pupils, and it was clearly unsuited to Leonardo's unhurried style. Instead, he decided to paint directly onto the dry plaster wall, which he coated with a layer of ground white stone and then white lead primer. He used tempera paint, in which pigments were mixed into water and egg yolk, along with oil paint, in which pigments were mixed into walnut or linseed oil. Recent scientific analysis of The Last Supper shows that he experimented with varying oil tempera proportions in different parts of the painting. Mixing water-based and oil-based pigments allowed him, or so he thought, to indulge in adding layer after layer of subtle strokes, building them up over weeks to create the shapes and tones he wanted. Leonardo finished the painting by early 1498, and the Duke rewarded him with a bonus of a vineyard near the church, which he owned for the rest of his life. But after only 20 years, the paint began to flake, and it became evident that Leonardo's experimental technique was a failure. When Vasari published his biography of Leonardo in 1550, he reported that the painting was ruined. By 1652, the painting was so faint and dissipated that the monks felt comfortable breaking a doorway through the wall at the bottom, cutting off the feet of Jesus, which were probably crossed in a manner prefiguring the crucifixion. Over the years, there have been at least six major attempts to restore the painting, many of which only made the situation worse. The first recorded effort was in 1726 by a curator who used oil paint to fill in missing sections and then put a coat of varnish on top. Less than 50 years later, another restorer stripped away all that the first had done and started repainting the faces on his own. A public outcry forced him to stop with only three faces left to be done. During the French Revolution, anti-clerical forces scratched out the eyes of the apostles, and then the refectory was used as a prison. A subsequent restorer tried to remove the painting from the wall, mistakenly thinking it was a fresco. In the early 20th century, two cleanings were done that avoided further damaging the painting and slowed its deterioration. Allied bombs hit the refectory during World War II, but the painting was protected by sandbags. The latest restoration, which began in 1978 and lasted 21 years, was the most extensive ever. Chief curator Pininfarina Barcelon and her team began by using infrared reflectoscopy and microscopic samples to try to discover, as best as possible, the original elements of the painting. She also had her restorers study Leonardo's drawings and the copies of the painting made during his lifetime. The original intention was to have the wall display only what could be known to be done by Leonardo's hand. But that turned out to be unsatisfying because so little remained. So the restorers reconstructed the missing areas in a way that indicated what was and wasn't original. Where it was not possible to discern the original artwork, the team used subtle watercolors with a lighter hue to give a sense of the original, while indicating that these sections were speculative. Not everyone was pleased. Art critic Michael Daly wrote that the result was a distinctly mongrel work showing alarmingly little original paint and very much alien compensatory and reintegrating new paint. But Brambilla Barcillon generally drew praise for creating and recreating what is, in fact, a piece of art that seems to be as deeply faithful to the original as is possible. Not only was the original color recovered, but also the clarity of the architectural structure, the perspective devices, and the physiognomies, she said. The faces, burdened with grotesque features from so many restorations, again manifest a genuine expressiveness. Now the faces of the apostles seem to genuinely participate in the drama of the moment and evoke the gamut of emotional responses intended by Leonardo to Christ's revelation. As a result, the Last Supper, both in its creation and in its current state, becomes not just an example of Leonardo's genius, but also a metaphor for it. It was innovative in its art and too innovative in its methods. The conception was brilliant, but the execution flawed. The emotional narrative is profound, but slightly mysterious. And the current state of the painting adds another thin veil of mystery to the ones that so often shroud Leonardo's life and work. Chapter 19. Personal Turmoil. Caterina's Death. On the rare occasions when he recorded a family event in his notebooks, Leonardo sometimes displayed a notarial tic of repeating the date. Thus he recorded the arrival of his mother, Caterina, now widowed and in her 60s, to live with him in Milan. On the 16th day of July. Caterina came on the 16th day of July, 1493. During her years with her husband, a Catabriga, Caterina had four daughters and a son. But sometime around 1490, her husband died and their son was killed by a shot from a crossbow. In his notebook shortly after that, Leonardo jotted, "Can you tell me what La Caterina wishes to do?" Apparently, she wanted to come live with him. On a page adjoining the one in his notebook where he records Caterina's arrival, Leonardo writes a rudimentary family tree that she likely helped him make, listing the names of his father and grandparents. In June 1494, she is included in an accounting of his expenses. He gives 3 soldi to Salai and 20 soldi to her. She apparently died later that month. A record in the State Archives of Milan reports, "On Thursday 26th of June, at the parish of the Saints Nabore and Felix at Porta Vercellina, Caterina from Florence, 60 years old, died of malaria." The evidence from the earlier archival records is that she was actually about 58, which is close enough to be in accord given the vagaries of records at the time. Leonardo sublimated whatever emotions he felt. He records nothing about her death, only an accounting of the cost of her funeral. On the listing of soldis he spent, he even crossed out the word death and wrote burial. Expenses for Caterina's burial. For 3 pounds of candle wax, 27 soldi. For the bier, 8 soldi. A pall for the biers, 12. For bearing and placing a cross, 4 soldi. For the bearers, 8 soldi. For 4 priests and 4 clerks, 20 soldi. Bell, book, sponge, 2 soldi. For the gravediggers, 16 soldi. For the dean, 8 soldi. For the license, 1 soldi. Total, 106 soldi. Earlier expenses, doctor, 5 soldi. Sugar and candles, 12 soldi. Grand total, 123 soldi. The detachment seems odd, and some have argued that the expenses seem low for a mother's funeral. He would spend 4 times as much in 1497 on the silver cloth, velvet trim, and tailoring for a cloak for Salai. But a careful look shows that it was in fact a funeral suitable for his mother rather than a household servant. It was brightly lit, featured 4 priests, and was carefully planned and recorded for posterity. Career struggles. When he began painting The Last Supper around 1495, Leonardo was at a high point in his career. With his official appointment as artist and engineer of the Sforza court, he was comfortably ensconced at Milan's old palace, the Corte Vecchia, with his retinue of assistants and students. He was renowned as a painter, admired as the sculptor of the mammoth clay model for the horse monument, beloved as a pageant impresario, and respected as a student of optics, flight, hydraulics, and anatomy. But his life became unsettled in the late 1490s, after Caterina's death and the completion of the Last Supper. The bronze for his horse monument had been redirected in 1494 to make cannon to defend against a possible French invasion, and it soon became clear that Ludovico was not going to replace it. Instead of major new commissions or portraits of ducal mistresses, he found himself doing interior design work and engaging in disputes over pay and performance. All the while, Duke Ludovico became increasingly preoccupied, and rightly so, by the French threats to his tenuous hold on power. One of Leonardo's projects was doing the decorative painting for a set of small rooms known as the Camerini in the Sforza Castle that the Duke planned to use as his private retreat. One of the vaulted wood-paneled rooms, the Sala delle Asse, was designed by Leonardo as an enchanted painted forest with 16 trees figuratively serving as an architectural fantasia of columns. Their branches intertwined in complex patterns worthy of his mathematical mind, and woven through this caprice was a golden rope that twisted into beautifully complex knots, a lifelong love of his. In the trees we find a beautiful invention by Leonardo, where all the branches transform themselves into bizarre knots, wrote Lomazzo. The execution did not go as well as the conception, as was often the case with Leonardo. There was a dispute, and one of the Duke's secretaries wrote in June 1496, "The painter who is decorating the Camerini caused something of a scandal today, and for this reason he has left." The secretary asked if someone could be sent from Venice to finish the work. That never happened, and Leonardo resumed the commission in early 1498, just as he was finishing work on the Last Supper. But there were other disputes that are revealed in letters drafted in his notebooks. One angry missive from 1497 has been ripped in half, so we have only fragments of sentences that express his frustration. "You remember the commission to paint the Camerini," reads one phrase. "Of the horse I will say nothing because I know the times are bad," is another. Then comes a tumult of complaints, including 2 years of my salary still not received. In another letter drafted for the Duke, Leonardo again complained about money and seems to imply that he had to put aside work on the Last Supper to make money by decorating the Sala delle Asse. "Perhaps Your Excellency did not give further orders to pay me, believing that I had money enough," he wrote. "It vexes me greatly that having to earn my living has forced me to interrupt the work and to attend to small matters, instead of following up the work which your lordship entrusted to me." As with the Last Supper, Leonardo was too slow-paced in painting the Sala delle Asse to put up with using the traditional fresco method that required each section to be executed rapidly on wet plaster before it dried. Instead, he again used a tempera oil mixture on a dry wall. The wood panels of the room had been removed, unfortunately. The dry plaster did not absorb the pigments, resulting in the same deterioration as suffered by the Last Supper. It was restored badly around 1901, salvaged in the 1950s, and in 2017 was in the midst of a more careful, laser-guided restoration. After his temperamental disputes involving the Sala delle Asse, Leonardo hit a low point. He found himself drafting job applications, including a letter written in the third person to the council of the nearby town of Piacenza, which was commissioning brass doors for the cathedral there. He wrote the letter extolling himself as if he planned to have a supporter send it on his behalf. "Open your eyes and look carefully that your money is not spent as to purchase your own shame," the letter reads. "There is not a man who is capable, and you may believe me, except Leonardo the Florentine, who is making the bronze horse of the Duke Francesco." Larger forces intervened to rescue Leonardo from his employment concerns. In the summer of 1499, an invasion force sent by the new French king, Louis XII, was bearing down on Milan. Leonardo added up the money in his cash box, 1,280 lira, distributed some to Salai, 20 lira, and others, and then proceeded to hide the rest in paper packets around his studio to keep it safe from invaders and looters. At the beginning of September, Duke Ludovico fled the city, which the French king entered a month later. As Leonardo feared, mobs destroyed the homes of many of his friends and looted their treasures. His studio was spared, but the French troops destroyed the clay model of his unbuilt horse monument by shooting arrows at it. The French were, it turned out, protective of Leonardo. The day after his arrival, the king went to see the Last Supper, and he even asked whether it might be possible to cart it back to France. Fortunately, his engineers told him it was impossible. Instead of fleeing, Leonardo spent the next few months working with the French. He made a note to contact one of the painters who had arrived in Milan with King Louis and to get from him the method of using dry colours and the white salt method and how to make coated paper. On the same page, he laid out a leisurely set of preparations for the long trip from Milan back to Florence and Vinci, which he would not begin until December. Have two covered boxes made to be carried on mules, one of which leave at Vinci. Buy some tablecloths, napkins, cloaks, caps and shoes, four pair of hose, a chamois jerkin, and skins to make new ones. Sell what you cannot take with you. In other words, he was not scurrying to escape from the French. In fact, he had forged a secret deal with the new French governor of Milan, the Count of Ligny, to meet him in Naples and act as a military engineer inspecting fortifications. In one of the most curious entries in his notebooks, on the same page as his list preparing for his trip, Leonardo writes not only in his mirror script, but using a simplistic code in which he spells names and cities backward. Go and find Ingil, Ligny, and tell him you will wait for him at Amor, Roma, and that you will go with him to Ilopan, Napoli. That plot never came to fruition. What made Leonardo finally leave Milan was the news that his former patron Ludovico was plotting a comeback. In late December, Leonardo made arrangements to transfer 600 florins from his Milanese bank to an account in Florence, then left with his retinue of assistants and his friend, the mathematician Luca Pacioli. 18 years after he had arrived in Milan with a lute and a letter for Ludovico proclaiming his talents as an engineer and artist, Leonardo da Vinci was returning home to Florence. Chapter 20. Florence Again. The Return. Leonardo's first stop on his journey back to Florence in early 1500 was the town of Mantua. There he was hosted by Isabella d'Este, the sister of Ludovico's late wife Beatrice, an avid and spoiled art collector from one of Italy's most venerable families. Isabella was eager to have a portrait of her done by Leonardo, and during his short stay, he dutifully made a preparatory chalk drawing. From there he went to Venice, where he offered military advice on defending against a threatened Turkish invasion. Always interested in the flow of water and its military uses, he devised a mobile wooden lock that he believed could allow the Isonzo River to flood a valley that would be used by any invaders. Like many of his visionary schemes, it was never implemented. He also dreamed up ideas for protecting a port such as Venice by equipping a corps of underwater defenders with diving suits, breathing gear, goggles, a mask, and wineskin airbags. The mask was attached to cane tubes that led up to a diving bell floating on the surface. After sketching some of these items in his notebook, he wrote that he was keeping a few of his plans secret. "Why is it that I do not describe my method for remaining underwater and how long I can remain there without coming up for air? I do not wish to publish this because of the evil nature of men who might use it for murder on the seabed." As with many of his inventions, his scuba gear was, at least during his time, just over the edge of practicality. It would be centuries before his ideas came to fruition. When Leonardo reached Florence in late March 1500, he found a city that had just lived through a reactionary spasm that threatened to destroy its role in the vanguard of Renaissance culture. In 1494, a radical friar named Girolamo Savonarola had led a religious rebellion against the ruling Medici and instituted a fundamentalist regime that imposed strict new laws against homosexuality, sodomy, and adultery. Some transgressions were punished by stoning and burning. A militia of young boys was organized to patrol the streets and enforce morals. On Mardi Gras of 1497, Savonarola led what became known as the Bonfire of the Vanities, in which books, art, clothing, and cosmetics were set aflame. The following year, popular opinion turned on him, and he was hanged and burned in the central square of Florence. By Leonardo's return, the city had again become a republic that celebrated the classics and art, but its confidence was shaken, its exuberance dampened, and the finances of its government and guilds drained. Leonardo would make Florence his base for most of 1500 to 1506, boarding comfortably with his entourage at the Church of Santissima Annunziata. In many ways, it would be the most productive period of his life. There he began two of his greatest panel paintings, the Mona Lisa and Virgin and Child with St. Anne, as well as an image of Leda and the Swan that is now lost. As an engineer, he would find work consulting on buildings, such as a structurally challenging church and serving the military aims of Cesare Borgia. And in his spare time, he would immerse himself again in mathematical and anatomical studies. Life at 50. As Leonardo approached the age of 50, living again in Florence, where he and his family were well known, he was comfortable being a distinctive character. Rather than try to conform, he made a point of being different, dressing and carrying himself as a dandy. At one point, he made an inventory in his notebook of clothing he had stored in a trunk. "One gown made of taffeta," he began. "One velvet lining that can be used as a gown. One Arab burnous. One gown of dusty rose. One rose-coloured Catalan gown. One cape of dark purple with wide collar and velvet hood. One coat of dark purple satin. One coat of crimson satin. One pair of dark purple stockings, one pair of dusty rose stockings, one pink cap." These might seem like costumes from one of his plays or masquerades, but we know from contemporary accounts that he actually dressed like this when walking about town. It is a delightful image. Leonardo in an Arab hooded cloak, or strolling in purple and pink garb, heavy on the satin and velvet. He was tailor-made for a Florence that had rebelled against Savonarola's Bonfire of the Vanities and was again willing to embrace flamboyant, eccentric, and artistic free spirits. Leonardo made sure that his companion, Salai, then 24, was dressed with similar brio, usually also in pink and rose. In one entry, Leonardo noted, "On this day I paid Salai 3 gold ducats which he said he wanted for a pair of rose-coloured hose with their trimming. The trimmings on the stocking must have been jewels. 4 days later, he bought Salai a cloak of silver cloth with green velvet trim." In the list Leonardo made of the clothing he had stored in a trunk, it is telling that his own clothes and those of Salai are mixed together, unlike the possessions of anyone else in the household. The clothes included a cape in the French mode, once owned by Cesare Borgia, belonging to Salai. Apparently, Leonardo had cloaked his young companion in a cape given to him by the notoriously vicious warlord who was briefly his father figure. If Freud had only known, the trunk also contained a tunic laced in the French fashion belonging to Salai, and a tunic of grey Flemish cloth belonging to Salai. These are not the types of garment that Leonardo or anyone else of the time bought for an ordinary house servant. It's reassuring to discover that Leonardo spent as much on books as he did on clothes. In the inventories he made in 1504, he listed 116 volumes. These included Ptolemy's Cosmography, which he later cited in describing the human circulation and respiratory system as a microcosm of the Earth's. He also acquired more books on math, including a 3-volume translation of Euclid and a book he described as being about the squaring of the circle, which was probably a text by Archimedes. There are many more texts on surgery, medicine, and architecture, but his tastes also ran to more popular fare. By then, he owned 3 editions of Aesop's Fables and multiple volumes of bawdy verse. He had also acquired the book on architecture written by his friend from Milan, Francesco Di Giorgio, who had been a collaborator in conceiving Vitruvian Man. He made annotations throughout and copied some passages and drawings into his notebook. Isabella d'Este's unpainted portrait. We can get an impression of Leonardo's life in Florence at this time by looking at the amusing tale of a commission he did not take. Soon after he arrived, he was besieged by entreaties from Isabella d'Este to fulfil his promise to paint a picture for her, either a portrait based on the chalk drawing he had made of her when he passed through Mantua, or, short of that, any other subject he chose. The saga of the two willful people with a beleaguered friar caught in the middle turned out to be so prolonged that it became, at least in retrospect, humorous as well as revealing of Leonardo's unwillingness to fulfil commissions that bored him. It also tells us about his interests in Florence, dilatory style, and aloof attitude towards wealthy patrons. Isabella, a strong-willed first lady of Mantua and a stronger-willed patron of art, was 26 at the time. She was the daughter of the Duke of Ferrara and a scion of the Este family, the richest and oldest noble clan in Italy. She had received a rigorous classical education in Latin, Greek, history, and music. From the age of 6, she had been betrothed to Francesco Gonzaga, the Marquis of Mantua. Isabella brought a dowry of 25,000 gold ducats, worth more than $3 million at 2017 gold prices, and her wedding in 1491 was lavish. After arriving in Mantua from Ferrara in a flotilla of more than 50 boats, she rode through the streets in a gold chariot cheered by 17,000 spectators and accompanied by ambassadors from a dozen realms. In an era of conspicuous consumption and competitive collecting, Isabella became the most conspicuous and competitive. She also triumphed in a tumultuous marriage. Her husband was a weak leader who was often away, at one point held hostage for 3 years in Venice, and she served as regent and took command of the city's military, holding off enemies. In return, her ungrateful husband conducted a long, passionate and public affair with the notoriously beautiful and evil Lucrezia Borgia, who was married to Isabella's brother. It was Lucrezia's third marriage. Her own brother, the brutal Cesare Borgia, had ordered her second husband to be strangled before her eyes. Isabella channeled her emotions into collecting art and, more specifically, seeking suitable portraits of herself. That proved difficult, because artists made the mistake of trying to produce passable likenesses, all of which she decried as making her look too fat. The respected Mantua court artist Andrea Mantegna tried in 1493, but Isabella pronounced, "The painter has done it so badly that it does not look like us in the least." After a couple of other unsatisfactory portraits, she tried again with a painter who worked for her family in Ferrara, but when she sent it to Milan as a gift, she apologized to Ludovico Sforza. "I am afraid that I shall weary not only your highness, but all Italy with the sight of my portraits," she wrote. "I send this one, which is not really very good, and makes me look fatter than I am." Ludovico, who apparently did not know the proper response to a woman who said a portrait made her look fat, responded that he thought the picture was a good likeness. At one point, Isabella lamented, "We only wish that we could be as well served by painters as we are by men of letters." Presumably, the many poets who dedicated poems to her could take more literary license with a subject than a painter could. In her continuing quest for the right artist to paint her, Isabella turned her sights on Leonardo. In 1498, soon after the death of her sister Beatrice, who had been married to Ludovico, Isabella wrote to Ludovico's mistress, Cecilia Gallerani, the subject of Leonardo's Lady with an Ermine. She wanted to compare that portrait to ones done by the Venetian painter Giovanni Bellini to determine which of the two artists would be her next target. "Having seen today some fine portraits by the hand of Giovanni Bellini, we began to discuss the works of Leonardo and wished we could compare them with these paintings," she wrote. "And since we remember that he painted your likeness, we beg you to be so good as to send us your portrait by this messenger whom we have dispatched on horseback, so that we may not only be able to compare the works of the two masters, but also have the pleasure of seeing your face again." She promised to return it. "I send it without delay," Cecilia replied, adding that it was no longer a good likeness. "But your highness must not think this proceeds from any defect in the master, for indeed I think there is no other painter to equal him in the world, but merely because the portrait was painted when I was much younger." Isabella liked the painting, but she kept her word and returned it to Cecilia. When Leonardo made his chalk drawing of Isabella on his way from Milan to Florence in early 1500, he also made a copy. He took it with him and showed it to a friend, who reported back to Isabella, "The portrait is exactly like you, and it could not be done better." Leonardo had left the original drawing with Isabella, who, in her flurry of subsequent correspondence, asked him to send a replacement because her husband had given it away. "Will you also beg him to send us another drawing of our portrait?" she wrote her agent, "since his lordship, our consort, has given away the one which he left here." The copy that Leonardo carried with him, which was large enough to be a preparatory cartoon for a painting, is likely the same drawing that is now in the Louvre. See figure 77 in the PDF. The portraits that Leonardo had painted in Milan show the sitters in Spanish-influenced dress, which had been the fashion. But Isabella was a trendsetter, and Leonardo drew her dressed in the very latest from France. That had an advantage. The loose sleeves and bodice hid her plumpness, though Leonardo gave her a hint of a double chin, only slightly disguised by his chalky sfumato. There is a willfulness to her mouth and a dignified formality in the choice of a profile pose, which was the standard for portraits of royalty. In most of his portraits, and all of those that were fully painted, Leonardo avoided the conventional approach of the period, which was to portray subjects in profile. Instead, he preferred to show his subjects facing the viewer or in three-quarters view, which allowed him to imbue them with a sense of motion and psychological engagement. Ginevra de Benci, Cecilia Gallerani, Lucrezia Crivelli, and Mona Lisa are posed this way. But these women were not royalty. Two were mistresses of Ludovico, and two were upper-class wives. Isabella instead insisted on being portrayed in the classical profile that conveyed courtly decorum. As a result, Leonardo's drawing of her is lackluster. We cannot see into her eyes or mind or soul. She seems to be posing. No thoughts or emotions seem to be churning inside. The fact that she could have viewed Cecilia's Lady with an Ermine and then asked Leonardo for a conventional pose indicates that she had more money than taste. That may be one reason Leonardo had no desire to turn the drawing into a painting. Even though this drawing was pricked for transferring onto a panel, Leonardo showed no signs of fulfilling Isabella's request to produce a portrait painting. She was used to getting what she wanted, however, and after waiting a full year, she decided to launch a lobbying campaign. Caught in the middle was a well-connected friar named Pietro da Novellara, who had been Isabella's confessor. "If Leonardo the Florentine, the painter, is to be found in Florence, we beg you will inform us what he is doing and whether he has begun any work," she wrote Pietro in late March 1501. "Your reverence might find out, as you best know how, if he, Leonardo, would undertake to paint a picture for our studio." The friar's reply, sent on April the 3rd, gives a glimpse into what Leonardo was doing and his reluctance to make commitments. "From what I hear, Leonardo's life is very irregular and uncertain, and he seems to live for the day only," Pietro wrote. His only art, the friar reported, was a preparatory drawing for what would eventually become his great painting of the Virgin and Child with St. Anne. "He has done nothing else, excepting that two of his apprentices are painting portraits to which he sometimes adds a few touches." As usual, Leonardo was distracted by other pursuits. As the friar said at the end of his letter, "He devotes much of his time to geometry and has no fondness at all for the paintbrush." He repeated that message after Salai arranged for him to meet with Leonardo. "I have succeeded in learning the intentions of the painter Leonardo by means of his pupil Salai and some of his other friends who took me to see him on Wednesday," Pietro wrote on April 14th. "In truth, His mathematical experiments have absorbed his thoughts so entirely that he cannot bear the sight of a paintbrush. As always, Leonardo was charming, even when he was not being accommodating. One issue was that when Louis XII of France took Milan, Leonardo had committed to do some paintings for him and his secretary, Florimond Roberti. If he can get free from his engagement with the King of France without displeasing him, which he hopes to do by the end of a month at latest, he would rather serve your excellency than any other person in the world, Pietro wrote, stretching the truth. But, in any case, as soon as he has finished a little picture which he is doing for a certain Roberti, a favourite of the King of France, he will do your portrait immediately. The friar described a painting Leonardo was working on that would become Madonna of the Yarn Winder. He ended with a note of resignation. This is all that I could get from him. Had he wished to comply with Isabella, it would have been a lucrative commission, one that he could have mostly delegated to his assistants. But Leonardo, although not wealthy, was beyond that. He occasionally led his patrons on, perhaps he even thought he might eventually gratify their wishes, but he rarely allowed himself to be subservient to them. When Isabella wrote to him directly in July 1501, he didn't even deign to send back a formal answer. I gave him to understand that if he wished to reply, I could forward his letters on to your ladyship and thus save his costs, reported Isabella's agent. He read your letter and said he would do so, but hearing nothing more from him, I finally sent one of my men to him to learn what he wished to do. He sent back the answer that for now he was not in a position to send another reply to your ladyship, but that I should advise you that he has already begun work on that which your ladyship wanted from him. He ended his letter with the same resigned lament as Pietro had used. In short, this is as much as I have been able to get from the said Leonardo. 3 years later, despite all the entreaties, Leonardo had not sent a painting, nor is there any evidence that he had begun one. Finally, in May 1504, Isabella changed tactics and asked him to paint for her instead a picture of the young Jesus. When you were in this city and drew our portrait in chalk, you promised us that you would some day paint it in colours, she wrote. But because this would be almost impossible, since you are unable to come here, we beg you to keep your promise by converting our portrait into another figure, which would be still more acceptable to us, that is to say, a youthful Christ of about 12 years old. Although she implied she would pay whatever he wanted, Leonardo was unmoved. Salai, not surprisingly, was more mercenary, and in January 1505 he offered his own services to do such a painting. A pupil of Leonardo Vinci, Salai by name, young in years but very talented, has a great wish to do some gallant thing for your excellency, her agent reported. So if you desire a little picture from him, you have only to tell me the price you are ready to pay. Isabella declined the offer. The final chapter came in 1506, when Isabella personally went to Florence. She was not able to meet with Leonardo, who was staying in the countryside doing studies on the flight of birds, but she did meet with Alessandro Amadori, the brother of Leonardo's stepmother, Albiera. He promised to use his influence. Here in Florence I act at all hours as the representative of your excellency with Leonardo da Vinci, my nephew, he wrote in May, after she returned to Mantua, and I do not cease to urge him by every argument in my power to satisfy your desire and paint the picture for which you asked him. This time he has really promised me that he will soon begin the work and satisfy your wish. Needless to say, Leonardo did not. He was pursuing more ambitious paintings, as well as his endeavours in anatomy, engineering, math, and science. Painting a conventional portrait for a pushy patron did not interest him. Nor did money motivate him. He painted portraits if the subject struck his fancy, such as the musician, or if a powerful ruler demanded it, as in the case of Ludovico with his mistresses. But he didn't dance to the music of patrons. Madonna of the Yarn Winder. Friar Pietro, in one of his letters to the persistent Isabella, described a painting that Leonardo was doing at the request of Louis XII's secretary, Florimond Roberti. The little picture he is working on is of a Madonna who is seated as if she were about to spin yarn, he wrote, and the child has placed his foot in the basket of yarns and has grasped the yarn winder and stares attentively at the four spokes, which are in the form of a cross, and he smiles and grips it tightly as if he were longing for this cross, not wishing to yield it to his mother, who appears to want to take it away from him. Dozens of versions of this picture, either by Leonardo or his assistants and followers, still exist, and there has been much debate by experts as well as some advocacy by owners and dealers regarding which might be the one Leonardo himself painted and sent to Roberté. Two of the surviving versions, known as the Buccleuch Madonna and the Lansdowne Madonna, see figure 78, are considered most likely to reflect the most involvement of Leonardo's own hand. But the quest to designate the real or original Leonardo version actually misses the larger meaning of the tale of the yarn winders. When he returned to Florence in 1500, Leonardo set up a collaborative workshop, and production of some pictures, especially small devotional ones, became a team effort, just as it had been in Verrocchio's studio. The emotional power of the yarn winder scene comes from the psychological complexity and intensity of the baby Jesus as he contemplates and grapples with the yarn winder, which is in the shape of a cross. Other painters had shown Jesus looking at objects that foretold the Passion, as Leonardo had done in the devotional paintings of the Madonna and Child. He had made Benoit Madonna and other little paintings in his early years, but the yarn winder paintings are energized by what had become Leonardo's special ability to convey a psychological narrative. There is a flow of physical motions as Jesus reaches toward the cross-like object, his finger pointed heavenward, the gesture that Leonardo loved. His moist eyes are shiny with a tiny sparkle of luster, and they have their own narrative. He is just the age when a baby can discern objects and focus on them, and he is doing so with a concerted effort that combines his sight with his sense of touch. We sense that his ability to focus on the cross causes a premonition of his fate. He looks innocent and at first playful, but if you look at his mouth and eyes, you sense a resigned and even loving comfort with what will be his destiny. By comparing Madonna of the Yarn Winder to the Benoit Madonna, figure 13, we can see the historic leap Leonardo made by turning static scenes into emotion-laden narratives. Our eyes swirl counterclockwise as the narrative continues with Mary's motions and emotions. Her face and her hand indicate anxiety, a desire to intervene, but also an understanding and an acceptance of what shall be. In the Virgin of the Rocks paintings, Mary's hovering hand offers a serene benediction, see figures 64 and 65. In the Yarn Winders, her gesture is more conflicted, as if coiled to grasp her child while also recoiling from the temptation to intervene. She reaches out nervously, as if trying to decide whether to restrain him from his fate. The Yarn Winder paintings are only the size of a page of a tabloid newspaper, but they include, especially in the Lansdowne version, Leonardo's marks of genius. There are the tightly coiled and lustrous curls on both mother and child. There is the river winding down from the mystical and misty mountains as if it were an artery connecting the macrocosm of the earth to the veins of the two human bodies. He knew how to have the light play on her thin veil, making it look lighter than her skin, but still letting the sunlight hit the top of her forehead and reflect back a shine. The sun highlights the leaves on the closest tree next to her knee, but as the trees recede, so does their distinctness, as Leonardo prescribed in his writings on acuity perspective. Also reflecting his scientific exactitude are the sedimentary layers of rocks on which Jesus leans. Leonardo's picture arrived at the French court in 1507, and Salai possessed a similar picture when he died, according to an accounting of his estate. But there is no clear historical documentation that connects either of these to the Lansdowne and Buccleuch versions, or to any of the at least 40 existing versions of the picture that have some claim to have been produced by Leonardo's studio. Given the lack of a historical record or documentary trail, people have used other methods to try to determine which of the yarn winder contenders is the original. One approach is connoisseurship, the ability of a true art expert with a refined eye to discern paintings by the master. Unfortunately, connoisseurship over the years, both in this case and others, has created more disagreements than it has resolved, and it has sometimes been proven wrong when new evidence arises. Another approach is scientific and technical analysis, which has been made more potent recently with infrared reflectography and other tools using multispectral imagery. Oxford professor Martin Kemp and his graduate student Teresa Crowe Wells began such a process of analysis in the early 1990s on the Buccleuch and then the Lansdowne Madonnas. One of their surprising discoveries is that both paintings have underdrawings that seem to have been made by Leonardo directly on the wood panel. In other words, they were not copied or transferred from a master preparatory drawing. The two underdrawings are similar, but interestingly, they were significantly modified in the course of creating the paintings. For example, in both underdrawings, there is a faint group of figures that includes Joseph making a baby walker for Jesus. It appears that Leonardo decided, as both paintings were being done, that the little scene was too much of a distraction, so it was left out. This and other bits of technical evidence point to the likelihood that the Lansdowne and Buccleuch versions were painted in the studio at the same time, with Leonardo overseeing and probably using his own hand on both. He probably had more of a hand in the Lansdowne and saw it to completion, given that it has the more Leonardo-esque landscape and lustrous curls. At least five of the surviving versions of the painting include the little scene of Joseph building the baby walker. This indicates that these versions were being painted in Leonardo's studio before he decided to eliminate the scene. In other words, the best way to make sense of the versions and variations of the painting is to imagine Leonardo in his studio creating and modifying the painting while his assistants are producing copies. This aligns with the impression we get from Pietro da Novellara's letter to Isabella d'Este, in which he describes the scene in Leonardo's studio where two of his apprentices are painting portraits to which he sometimes adds a few touches. In other words, we should put aside our romantic image of the artist alone in his studio creating works of genius. Instead, Leonardo's studio was like a shop in which he devised a painting and his assistants worked with him to make multiple copies. This is similar to the way it had been in Verrocchio's Bottega. The process of production is more in keeping with the commissioning of a superbly made chair from a major designer craftsman, Kemp wrote after the results of the technical analysis. We do not ask if a certain glued joint in the chair was made by the head of the workshop or one of his assistants, providing the joint holds and looks good. In the case of the Madonna of the Yarnwinder, as it was with the two versions of the Virgin of the Rocks, we should modify the traditional questions asked by art historians. Which version is the authentic or autograph or original one? Which are mere copies? Instead, the proper and more interesting questions to ask are, how did the collaboration occur? What was the nature of the team and the teamwork? As with so many examples in history where creativity was turned into products, Leonardo's Florence studio involved individual genius combined with teamwork. Both vision and execution were required. Because it was delivered to the French court and extensively copied, Madonna of the Yarnwinder turned out to be one of Leonardo's most influential paintings. Leonardo's followers, such as Bernardino Luini and Raphael, and soon painters throughout Europe, upended the genre of staid Madonna and Child devotional paintings, creating instead narratives of emotional drama. Raphael's 1507 painting, Madonna of the Pinks, for example, is often compared to Leonardo's Benoit Madonna, which it closely mimics, but in fact, we can see that Raphael has also picked up on Leonardo's ability in the Yarnwinder to imbue a work with psychological movements. The same is true of Luini's Madonna of the Carnation and Madonna with Child and Young St. John. In addition, the Yarnwinder set the stage for one of the most richly layered of Leonardo's masterpieces, another depiction of the emotional swirl that occurs when the baby Jesus apprehends his destiny, this one adding Mary's mother, St. Anne, to the drama. Chapter 21. St. Anne. The Commission. When Friar Pietro de Novellara was floundering in his mission to convince Leonardo to paint a portrait for Isabella d'Este, he wrote to her in April 1501 to explain the situation. Since he has been in Florence, he has only made one sketch, a cartoon of a child Christ about a year old, almost jumping out of his mother's arms to seize hold of a lamb. The mother is in the act of rising from St. Anne's lap and holds back the child from the lamb, which is a symbol of the Passion. The cartoon that the friar described was a full-size preparatory drawing for what would become one of Leonardo's greatest masterpieces, The Virgin and Child with St. Anne, featuring Mary sitting on the lap of her mother. See figure 79 in the PDF. The final painting combines many elements of Leonardo's artistic genius, a moment transformed into a narrative, physical motions that match mental emotions, brilliant depictions of the dance of light, delicate sfumato, and a landscape informed by geology and color perspective. It was proclaimed to be Leonardo da Vinci's ultimate masterpiece, L'ultime chef d'œuvre, in the title of the catalogue published by the Louvre for a 2012 exhibition celebrating its restoration. This from the museum that also owns the Mona Lisa. The story of the commissioning of the painting probably began when Leonardo returned to Florence from Milan in 1500 and took up residence at the Church of Santissima Annunziata. The monks there regularly provided accommodation to distinguished artists, and Leonardo was given 5 rooms for himself and his assistants. It was wonderfully convenient. The monastery had a library with 5,000 volumes, and it was only 3 blocks from the Santa Maria Nuova Hospital, where Leonardo performed his dissections. The monks had commissioned an altarpiece by Filippino Lippi, the Florentine painter, who had painted an Adoration of the Magi for a nearby church after Leonardo had abandoned that commission. Leonardo let it be known that he would gladly take on the job of painting the altarpiece himself, and as Vasari wrote, when Filippino heard this, like the good-hearted person he was, he decided to withdraw. Another factor working in Leonardo's favour, his father was the notary for the church. Different versions. Once he got the commission, Leonardo typically procrastinated. He kept them waiting a long time without even starting anything, Vasari wrote. Then he finally did the cartoon showing Our Lady with St. Anne and the infant Christ. The cartoon was a sensation, evidence that Leonardo was now wildly famous in his hometown and that he was leading the way for artists to rise from being nameless artisans to being individual public stars. Men and women, young and old, continued for 2 days to flock for a sight of it to the room where it was, as if to a grand festival, to gaze at the marvels of Leonardo, Vasari recorded. Vasari was presumably referring to the cartoon that Friar Pietro had described to Isabella d'Este. Unfortunately, Vasari confused matters by reporting that the drawing also included St. John depicted as a little boy playing with a lamb. The fact that Vasari's description does not comport exactly with that of the friar, who makes no mention of St. John, is not surprising. It was probably just a mistake. Vasari, whose accuracy was invariably well below perfect, was writing 50 years later, and he never saw the cartoon in question. But his injection of St. John into the picture reflects an interesting historical mystery that Leonardo scholars still wrestle with, because some of Leonardo's versions and variations on the drawing did indeed include St. John in place of, not playing with, the lamb. The cartoon that Friar Pietro wrote about, comprising Anne, Mary, Jesus, and a lamb, has the same 4 elements as the painting now in the Louvre. But here's the wrinkle. The only surviving cartoon by Leonardo related to this project is a drawing now in London known as the Burlington House Cartoon, because of the Royal Academy headquarters where it was long displayed. See figure 80. Beautiful and haunting and large, it features St. Anne, the Virgin Mary and the baby Jesus, but with a young St. John and no lamb. In other words, it is not the cartoon that Friar Pietro saw in 1501. Scores of Leonardo scholars have puzzled over the sequencing of the various versions of the arrangement. There is the cartoon described by Friar Pietro that was publicly displayed and then apparently lost, the surviving Burlington House cartoon, and the Louvre painting. In which order did Leonardo create these? For much of the late 20th century, the consensus among scholars, including Arthur Popham, Philip Pouncey, Kenneth Clark, and Carlo Pedretti, was that Leonardo began with the cartoon described by Friar Pietro, with a lamb but no St. John, in 1501, then changed his mind and drew the Burlington House cartoon a few years later, with St. John but no lamb, then changed his mind again and reverted to a final painted version that resembled the 1501 drawing, Lamb and No St. John. That theory was based on stylistic grounds, and because some mechanical drawings on the reverse of a sketch for the Burlington House cartoon seem to have been done around 1508. This contorted sequencing began to be revised in 2005, when a note by Agostino Vespucci, who was Machiavelli's secretary and Leonardo's friend, was found in the margin of a book by Cicero he was reading. The ancient Roman philosopher had written that the painter Apelles perfected the head and bust of his Venus with the most elaborate art, but left the rest of her body in the rough. Vespucci wrote next to this passage, "So Leonardo da Vinci does in all his paintings, such as the head of Lisa del Giocondo and Anne, Mother of the Virgin." His note is dated October 1503. Thus, in one little discovery, there is confirmation that in 1503, Leonardo had started painting the Mona Lisa, and that he had already begun work on the St. Anne painting. If Leonardo was already working on his final painting in 1503, it makes little sense to think that the Burlington House cartoon was done after that. Instead, it may have been done shortly after his return to Florence, or perhaps even as early as 1499, before he left Milan. He could have been planning the painting before he got the commission, and indeed might have volunteered for the commission because he had a composition that he had initially intended to do for some other patron. It seems likely that Leonardo began the Burlington House cartoon while he was still in Milan, wrote Luke Sison in the catalogue for a 2011 London exhibition that included the cartoon. His patron may well have been the French king Louis XII, whose wife was Anne of Brittany. That theory that the Burlington House cartoon was the first in the sequence was reinforced in a masterful 2012 exhibition at the Louvre, celebrating the completion of a 12-year restoration of the St. Anne painting. The exhibition brought together the painting and the Burlington House cartoon for the first time since Leonardo's death, along with compositional sketches, preparatory drawings, and copies made by Leonardo's students and other painters. In addition, technical studies, including multispectral analysis of the painting and cartoon, were presented. The conclusion was unequivocal, according to the curator, Vincent Delievin. After working through, then abandoning the solution shown in the Burlington House cartoon, Leonardo developed a different conception and drew a second cartoon in 1501, in which St. John the Baptist had been replaced by a lamb, the one that Fra Pietro de Novellara described in a letter to Isabella d'Este. The final painted version is based on the 1501 cartoon, but with one change. The figures are reversed. In the painting, and in its underdrawing, discovered by an infrared reflectographic analysis, the lamb and the young Jesus are on the right side, not the left. By looking at some of the smaller sketches Leonardo made, we can see him working out options for showing how the young Jesus would squirm off his mother's lap and wrestle with the lamb. He thinks by sketching. It is a process he called componimento inculto, an uncultivated composition that helps work out ideas through an intuitive process.